You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Bob, tomorrow's your birthday.
Oh, yeah. Oh. That's right. Yeah, big 4th of July party.
Ooh. Born on the 4th of July. Always a big event in a Novella household.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
What are you guys doing?
Have about 30 people over, and we're going to have lots of food. Going to have some amazing cake. She's making me right now a peanut butter ice cream cake right now.
Yeah.
It's going to be epic. And to prevent other people from eating it as much as they normally would, I bought a cake.
Just got to breathe on it?
Like a classic birthday sheet cake, a sheet cake. So I'm hoping a lot of people gravitate towards that and not so much towards the peanut butter one. They can eat whatever they want, but I'm just playing the odds.
What's the fireworks sitch like in Connecticut where you all live?
Well, basically a lot of towns, all the major towns will have a display. When I used to live in Danbury and you could see from my deck like six or seven different towns in the distance, you could see literally like four or five different decent sized displays going off. These are like town size, not nothing like, Disney sized or New York sized. But so the towns do it, and then there's lots of people. I'll hear fireworks at my house. Yeah,
how
lots
are the
of people.
Illegal fireworks?
Yeah, yeah. It's technically not legal, but it's not really policed.
They don't do much about it. Yeah,
L.A.
Yeah.
Nope. is known for our loot. I mean, it's already started, right?
It started here too.
Yeah, and every year I'll sometimes scan around the horizon with my binoculars for trees that are on fire. It's so bad.
Oh my God.
What are you doing?
Bob, we're bringing a tabbouleh salad. That's been our...
Nice.
Sweet.
Our contribution for the last 20 years or so. So that's a parsley-based salad. But here's the thing. I love the tabbouleh salad that we make. But it's very labor-intensive.
Yeah.
Because you have to pull all the stems off of the parsley.
But there's a quick way to do it.
No, there really isn't.
A little hole.
It depends on what your tolerance is for stems. If you want to just pull all the big stems off and you're okay with the little stems, that's the cheaty way to do it. But if you want even the little stems gone, you have to do more than that. You have to almost pull them all off individually. Yeah. You could sometimes do them like in little clusters, But like what restaurants do is they just chop it all up, But then you get the little
Yeah, you don't want that stuff. Yeah, you don't want to pull them out.
Because it's too hard to, it's too gritty.
I think they're a little more bitter too. Like you really just, it's so much better without it.
Yeah. It's a labor of love. It's like one thing is like we all get together. We spend hours pulling freaking leaves off a little parsley.
All right. So back to me now. So I actually created a tombstone for me for the party. It just says Bob in this really cool font. And on the bottom, it says my birth year. And then nothing. I was going to do goofy stuff, but I'm like, I'm just going to do. It's not finished yet, obviously. Yeah.
No way. And
it looks really good. It looks really like old. It looks like a tombstone that's been sitting out in a field for like 300 years. It looks awesome.
Proud of you.
Yeah. So am I.
You got hundreds of years to go. What with technology is going to save the day, and reverse aging, all that stuff is coming.
That
right
would
around
be nice.
Corner.
I think we're going to just miss that technology, unfortunately.
Right? Oh my gosh, it's sad to think about the things we're just going to miss.
Well, it depends on how you define just. But yeah,
there's also probably a lot of things you're going to miss that you should be happy about.
Well, that's true too.
True. Yeah. Yeah. Like my poor mom. She catches snatches of climate change news here and there, and she's like, the tornadoes in Connecticut. That's it. That's it. She had some crazy wind at her place 2 days in a row last week. I mean, it was cyclonic
and it was
intense. She's like, that's it. With the climate change, we basically in her mind, Connecticut now has tornadoes just like Tornado Alley. F3, F4, F5, whatever it takes. She's like, that's it. Like, Mom, it's not nearly – Connecticut is still safe. It's not Tornado Alley. It's like, come on. Oh, my God.
I mean, we had a horrible one 7 years ago. It was
bad.
Isn't
there a horrible hurricane that's like the – maybe not the earliest, but that's like unseasonably early battering Jamaica right now.
Right now, yeah. They think it'll... Is that the one that will eventually hit Texas, they're
Barrel.
Forecasting?
Yeah, I think it's a Category 5 already.
I think that was the earliest Category 5 ever.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I knew it was early.
It's very early.
But I didn't know if it was the earliest.
I read it was the earliest Cat 5 ever.
Well, yeah, that's
our life. Can you imagine? I can't even imagine what it's going to be like 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now. Steve, did you see that news item where they're saying that their temperature predictions now are just like going to be ridiculously off, and now they're looking at 5-6 degrees? It was by 2100 or something. It was I couldn't even finish the article. It was just like, oh my god!
How will the food supply not collapse? I mean,
6 degrees Celsius is extreme, right? That's when you start to hit multiple tipping points where, like, the Earth's climate is changed for thousands of years, you know?
Right, in which crops can't sufficiently grow, to feed people.
Well, they'll move.
They'll shift, yeah. But it will have a massive impact.
Oh, my gosh, the disruption will be...
Yeah, we'll see. The big problem is going to be climate refugees. Like, people will have to...
Oh, sure.
I got to leave my country now because it's actually too hot to live.
Get away from the center.
It's not just hot. It's because it's underwater. It's because of all these different things. And Bob, Beryl, the hurricane, I just looked it up. It's broken like multiple records. Easternmost to form in the tropical Atlantic in June. Earliest Category 4 hurricane on record in the basin. Strongest June hurricane as measured by wind speed. And... earliest Category 5 hurricane on record.
Mm. Yep.
Gosh, I can't remember a June hurricane. I mean, not in my lifetime.
Yep, and 2024 is on track to be either the warmest or second warmest year on record.
Oh, man.
So it's still happening.
For second warmest.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not going to stop.
Yeah, this is not something that's going to happen in the future. It's going to get worse in the future, but it is happening.
But tomorrow... the weather will be nice for Bob's birthday.
That's right.
Are you sure? I saw a little sprinkles later in the day.
No. Those are for the ice cream later, Bob. Sprinkles.
Well, Bob, why don't you start us off with a quickie?
All right. Thank you, Steve. This is your quickie with Bob. Caltech researchers have created these really cool, unprecedented simulations that are both at the galactic scale and the stellar scale at the same time, allowing them to zoom from one to the other. Which has never been possible before. And the resolution of this simulation is a whopping 1,000 times greater than the previous best such simulations. So amazing improvement, three orders of magnitude in one simulation. That's pretty awesome. Their biggest discovery so far is that black holes are more dominated by magnetic fields than they ever thought. So when they ran the simulation, they zoomed in really tight into a supermassive black hole. And this is where theoretical astrophysicist Phil Hopkins said, "In our simulation, we see the accretion disk form around the black hole. We would have been very excited if we had seen just that accretion disk, but what was surprising was that the simulated disk doesn't look like what we've thought for decades it should look like." Now, I've described black hole accretion disk many times, and I always basically say, oh, this is a flat disk, right, that goes around the black hole. It turns out it's not as flat as we thought. These researchers describe it as fluffy like angel cake accretion disk around a black hole. So what the simulation showed was that the amazing heat pressure that exists in an accretion disk is not the dominating force that we thought. The pressure from the magnetic fields are actually 10,000 times greater than the heat from the gas in the disk. It's the boss. Magnetic field is the boss. Hopkins said again, so the disks are almost completely controlled by the magnetic fields. The magnetic field serves many functions, one of which is to prop up the disks and make the material puffy. So this can have a dramatic change in the predictions that they make about accretion disks, like how massive are they, how dense they are, how fast the hot gas moves from the disk into the black hole, and even their very geometry. So the next time you look at a black hole accretion disk, don't think pancake, think fluffy angel cake. This has been your Quickie with Bob. Back to you, Steve.
Now I'm hungry.
I wonder how fluffy they are, though. I mean, how
yeah,
far above and below that ecliptic,
it's a bit nebulous,
if you would.
Hey, yo.
Thanks.
But it's interesting. Imagine you zoom in, like, holy crap, that does not look like we've thought it looked like for like forever, right? It's always pictured as this flat disk orbiting the black hole.
Bob, what do you think about DNA nano killbots?
I love it. I love them so much. Yeah, I love the title of your blog post on
Holy
that.
Holy
moly. Yeah. So yeah, the DNA nanorobot kill switch for cancer. This is a coming together of a few technologies that have been in the works for a long time. As we often say on the show, technology always has way deeper roots than you think. Yeah. It takes a long time for things to go from the first inkling of an idea to like something practical that's happening. But we've taken a big step here. Here's the actual paper. A DNA robotic switch with regulated autonomous display of cytotoxic ligand nanopatterns. All right, so what does all that mean? So first, let's talk about DNA origami. I know we've talked about it on the show before. Making robots or nanomachines or whatever, just little nano shapes out of DNA is a technology that's been in the work for a couple decades at least. And the idea is that, you know, DNA is a complicated molecule that you could, you know, because it has the four different base pairs, you can actually structure it, right? You could design the sequence so that it will take on a certain three-dimensional shape, right? DNA origami refers to not only that, but the ability to change shapes, right? So now you have a DNA nanoscale, quote-unquote, robot that can alter its shape. That's a DNA origami. Get it?
Yes.
All right. So what the researchers were trying to do is come up with a DNA, you know, a DNA nanobot that would kill cancer cells. There's another little background concept here. When we try to kill cancer cells, the one of the big approaches, like this conceptually speaking, is you ask, well, what's different about the cancer cells than healthy cells? And can we use that, whatever it is, to target the cancer cells, right? Chemotherapy is premised on the notion that cancer cells have a higher reproductive rate, a higher dividing rate than normal healthy cells. And so if you use drugs that target rapidly reproducing or rapidly dividing cells, it will disproportionately affect cancer cells over healthy cells.
Well, early chemo does that. Yeah, all chemo does that. But that's how chemo started.
That's one basic concept behind a lot of, especially the classic.
Taxol
chemotherapies. Yeah. But then there's other ones that's like, well, they also need more blood supply. So we'll target things that grow more blood vessels. And now we're looking at more molecular targets. Yeah, well, they have this genetic difference or this, whatever. Whatever we can identify that is different about cancer cells, you can target it, right? This research targets not something about the cancer cells themselves, but the environment of solid cancer tumors. And what that is that the pH is lower. They tend to be more acidic. So it's like, okay, so can we design a DNA origami that will be in one shape at a normal pH, a normal body pH that's not dangerous, and then another shape at the acidic pH of a solid cancer, you know, tumor that will be deadly. So they use what they call death receptors, DRs, death receptors.
Don't let the name scare you.
Yeah. And so this is a ligand of about 6 amino acids. These are ubiquitous. They exist on all healthy cells, right? But when they're sufficiently clustered together, what they trigger apoptosis. Apoptosis is programmed cell death.
Death.
A death switch, a kill switch, right? I.e. death receptor. So what they did was they created a hexagon of clustered death receptors in the middle of this DNA. And at normal pH, it's folded up and it covers it. And then at acidic pH of a tumor, it opens up. That's the DNA origami, revealing the cluster of death receptors.
Nice.
And then triggering apoptosis.
So then that would interface with the cell wall and trigger apoptosis?
Yeah. How does the cell itself then?
It's like a self-destruct mechanism.
No, because it binds to the death receptors on the cells, right?
Yeah, but the problem that I see with this, I mean, I see it being helpful, is that one of the eight hallmarks of cancer is that they resist apoptosis. So even if you try to induce apoptosis, they're probably going to develop a resistance to that pretty quickly.
But that's why they had to develop a like really strong signal, right? It's like it's not just one
like
death
stronger
receptor,
than what the body would
it's
ever
a cluster,
make.
This cluster of death receptors. Yeah,
ooh, an array.
you know, resistance is another issue, right? That's
Resistance is futile.
Not with
sadly, and cancer resistance is really good. Right. Yeah.
Cancer has a few exceptions.
It's an interesting, the thing that always worries me about all these, it doesn't worry me, it's huge and it's super important, about all these new approaches to utilizing things that cells know how to do to die,
mm-hmm.
is that cancer cells are
by definition they bypass
evolving, a way not to do that anymore.
All right, so they tested it, right? Okay. Good in theory, but of course, does it work? So they had a mouse model of induced human breast cancer, right? They basically mm-hmm. gave mice human breast cancer. And then they had control mice and mice that they treated with these DNA killbots. And the tumor growth was reduced in the treated group by 70%.
Whoa. Okay, that's insignificant.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Not 100%, but it's by 70%. And that's out of the gate. So they're hoping they can get that figure higher. So here's the next step, is that they want to include on the outside of the DNA receptors that are specific for the individual tumor type, which is another thing that is happening in the cancer world, is like you're figuring out how to
hone in on it.
Yeah, to target, like to find out this cancer, your cancer has this receptor, this marker, this DNA sequence, whatever. We're going to target that specifically. So that will increase the concentration of these killbots in the cancer and decrease the concentration outside of it.
Yeah, did they determine what areas these killbots? Because, like, you know, obviously, as you said, early chemos target rapidly dividing cells. So that's why you mm-hmm. see hair loss. That's why you see, you know, problems with your fingertips, neuropathy, all that kind of stuff. What areas have that high pH?
The low pH.
Or sorry, that low pH. Like, what off target sites?
Your stomach.
Oh, the stomach's even lower. It's not just low pH, it's a specific pH.
It's this specific pH. Yeah. Like, I'm so curious about what off-target sites.
Yeah, so that's obviously the big concern, right? You're injecting killbots into a body. Uh-huh. Yeah, so the safety is going to be the big concern. You want to make sure there's minimal off-target damage, right?
Right.
You don't want to be like, oh, yeah, and it also induced your pancreas to explode. Like, you obviously don't want that to happen. So there's going to be, I think there's going to be a shit ton of safety testing. Preclinical before it ever sees a human, and then obviously clinical testing if it looks good at that point. So it's an interesting idea. It's a novel approach. I like the, you know, utilizing multiple different, you know, high tech thingies in order to kill cancer cells in this novel way. And again, you read about these new cancer treatments and it looks like it should just eviscerate the cancer.
Right.
But it's always like 50% reduction, 60% reduction, whatever. It's always a partial treatment.
Yeah.
Partly for the reasons you say, Kara, that cancer is good at evading it. But the thing is, you add a bunch of them together.
Right.
That's when you
aim
for
that. You beat the cancer back far enough that the immune system could do the rest, right?
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, that's the thing that's so scary about cancer is it. I'm not saying 70% is no percent. It's not like an eclipse, right?
Yeah,
like because every intervention.
It's all about survival, right?
Yeah,
it
gives you more time. But ultimately, if there's any cancer left, it's going to divide and come back. That's just how cancer works.
Right, but that's why you want to kick it when it's down, right? So you want to, all right, so first of all, we're going to remove the bulk of it. Then
yes.
we're going to use radiation therapy and chemotherapy. And now we're also going to hit it with this kill switch. Maybe that will get rid of whatever, mop up whatever's left. That's the idea. It's like you keep hitting it over and over again with multiple different things.
Yeah.
And then even if it's – so either you cure it or you put it – you knock it back so far that it's going to be 10 years before it comes back or whatever.
Right.
So you're just trying to extend life as much as possible.
Yeah, and the hope, yes, is that you can always remove it completely. It's always interesting to me when I have a new patient who has a new diagnosis and there's like a, why can't they just give me this drug? Why do they have to do surgery? It's like, oh, you're a candidate for surgery? This is a good thing.
Yeah.
It is always a good thing if they can cut the cancer out of your body. Mm-hmm. It's actually one of the only really, really curative things.
Yeah, although bloodborne cancers are very curable these days. And
yeah,
there's
that's
no solid
too.
Tumor,
yeah,
but
yeah.
that's just for different reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, but we have to think of each of these cancer treatments as a partial treatment, yeah. as incremental.
Right. In an arsenal.
This gets
yeah.
us, you know, every year cancer survival improves by about 1%, and it's because of this kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. Because nothing is a cure for cancer. It's a home run. It's just, we just keep making these steady incremental advances. One more thing to knock cancer back on its heels.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's not in every type of cancer for everyone, right? It's like, this one is more about solid tumors. Other ones are better at blood, born cancers, or whatever. Some are better at metastatic cancers or whatever, or preventing metastasis or preventing recurrence. Or it's just one more tool. And I think it's been very encouraging. The immunotherapies, I think, are the real the recent immunotherapies against cancer.
Oh, they've been amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, some of them have fully reversed. It is really interesting to see them do things that we didn't know was possible.
Right. Again, not an abject cure, but it's like a solid, solid progression in treating cancer. So, yeah. But of course, this news item is more than just about treating cancer. It's also just exciting to see how good DNA we're getting with the DNA origami robots.
What else can you do with it?
Yeah, because there's a lot of potential applications for that, not just in medicine, but also in manufacturing as well.
And assassinations, too.
But then you can combine that with some sort of nano or tiny robot, maybe not nano, but micro, maybe nano, that targets the drug. Now we're really cooking with fire.
Yeah, it could also be opening up and releasing targeted chemotherapy or whatever, There's lots of things you can use this for. Bob, this is actual nanotechnology, this kind of stuff.
It's the real thing,
absolutely.
Bob.
Absolutely.
You should be more excited than you are right now.
I mentioned it on a recent podcast, is that nanotech is really just taking pre-existing bio-nanotech and tweaking it, from bacteria to DNA to our own cells, taking that and tweaking it and bending it to our will. That's that's where nanotechnology is really going to flourish.
I also wonder if these DNA origami robots, especially if they're targeted with some kind of specific surface receptor, could be a good vector for CRISPR or some other genetic modification. Cross those streams. A lot of interesting stuff happening. All right, now we're going to go to some other cool tech. Jay, tell us about this new bionic leg.
Yeah, Steve. So first of all, just so everybody knows, Steve and I talked a lot about this news item. It's complicated, but I can't help but geek out a little bit because this seems to be a pretty significant advancement. And, we're getting into science fiction zone now.
Oh, yeah. This is $6 Million Man stuff.
This is really interesting. So Steve will sharpen the edges here. But anyway, a couple of interesting things. First, guys, how many Americans do you think are suffering from limb loss right now?
Oof. Oh, gosh.
A lot.
Almost 2 million.
1%.
Wow. Almost 2 million. Yeah, it's a significant number of people. It significantly changes the person's life in lots of different ways. Of course, the limb that they lost is a factor. Also, what happened to them to lose the limb, because it's not just losing the limb. They could have been injured in other ways. It's a big deal. It's a very emotional thing to go through, and it's a very hard thing to deal with on the other end of that. Unfortunately, through these statistics that I was reading, they were saying that this number is expected to double by 2050.
Wow.
So there was a recent study at MIT that involved a new neuroprosthesis controlled entirely by the nervous system. So the new bionic leg that they developed, when paired with the newly developed amputation technique, which is called agonist-antagonist myoneural interface, or AMI, they reported that this preserves muscle and brain signaling, pre-existing muscle and brain signaling, which provides the wearer more natural movement sensation. And this is very important. So what they did was they took 14 existing amputees. These are not people who, they weren't getting their leg amputated for this. It was people that had already had the amputation surgery. They took 7 of them and they said, okay, these are going to be the control. We're going to let them use the new bionic limb, but we're not going to give them the specialized new surgery technique that they came up with. And of course, the other 7 got the new surgery technique. That's the AMI. So what they ended up doing with this new surgery technique is they changed the anatomy of the amputation site. And this preserved the communication between these two muscles. Now, what were those two muscles called, Steve?
The tibialis anterior and the gastrocnemius.
Right.
It's so interesting. We always pronounce that gastrocnemius. We didn't pronounce the k. I think do you think that's a regional difference?
It might be.
Interesting.
I mean, we'll say gastroc for short.
That's so those two muscles, guys, that's interesting. Okay.
They are the agonist and the antagonist muscles. That's what the name of the procedure is called, because those two muscles actually communicate with each other. They designed a new cup that the leg goes into that has pressure sensors in it. So the person that's using it, the leg muscles are actually feeling the movement of the limb with more clarity, right? And that sends information back to the brain. So just the the operation site and the cup are where all the magic is happening. So typically, with more recent artificial limbs, they would be using artificial intelligence to create these pre-programmed movements that simulate the movement or mimic the movement of a human, leg movement, say, for example. But that isn't really coming from the person that's operating the limb. It's coming from like a program, and they have to kind of ride on top of that, which is odd. So what they realized was they have to let the person control the limb, and their goal was to try to get them to make the limb feel more normal, to feel like it's a part of their body. So they're in control. They're not like being controlled by software. They are actually in control of the limb. So here's how it works. So the neuroprosthesis uses sensors that are placed between the amputation site and the bionic leg, right? That's in the cup, like I said. And these transmit electrical signals from the brain. Now, this setup allows the prosthetic to sense its position and its movement, like, you know, how fast is it moving, what position it's in, oriented in 3D space, and this sends information back to the patient. This perception of your limb movement is called proprioception, and it's very important to have a functioning proprioception in order for you to know where your body is at all time, where you move your fingers independently from each other, and you understand exactly where your hands and fingers are in 3D space because you could feel it, and that information is coming back from the limb or the finger or whatever, going back to your brain. This is what they did. They were able to send information back to the brain that previously was much less, right? So now they were able to get it up to 18% of what a natural proprioception would be like.
Which I think it was just 18% more than the control group. That's my reading.
Bionic limb could be controlled using just 18% of natural proprioception. That's what the article said.
Ooh, is that what the scientific article said or the write around said? Because that might be a mistake.
I think the actual study said that the bionic limb could be controlled using just 18% of natural proprioception.
And that's all it takes for them to be able to kind of. I guess here's an interesting question, Jay. Like, when I think about case studies where somebody has lost proprioception, like because of a weird brain thing after anesthesia or something like that, they have to physically look at their limbs in order to control them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can imagine that maybe the individuals in the control group had to look down at their legs when they would move them. Can these individuals walk without looking down?
Yeah, I think
well,
so.
Wow. For sure.
That's, yeah, so what?
But Jay, to clarify, again, this is a very technical article. I didn't even read the write around. I went right to the technical article because the other one was hopeless in my opinion. But here's right from the abstract. In a cohort of 7 leg amputees, the interface is shown to augment residual muscle afferents by 18% of biologically intact values. Right. So it's augmenting by 18%.
Right. Okay. So what that was able to do, so that 18% gave the amputees that had the surgery, it increased their walking speed by 41%, and that matches the walking speed of people that don't have amputations. So that's profound because it puts them right back to a normal level of walking speed, which gives them, you know, they have enough sensation and control and understanding of where the limb is to a degree where they are moving what would be considered to be a typical movement of someone that doesn't have an amputation. And interestingly, the person who led the study, Dr. Hugh Herr, he's the principal investigator. He noted that this is the first bionic leg that's fully controlled by the nervous system to achieve natural walking speeds and gait patterns. And he happens to be a double amputee. He had a hiking accident happen, and I think he lost both of his legs. Oof. So, he said, this is a quote from him, "It feels natural as if the limb were made of flesh and bone." And that's a pretty big thing to say.
That's amazing, right?
But,
there, that quote.
You know, I really enjoyed reading some quotes from people that were in the study. One person said, "I didn't feel like my leg had been amputated. It was the happiest moment of my life."
Wow.
When she first walked on it, that was her emotional and response to it. Like, "I feel like I have a leg." So it's a big deal. Now, again, this was, you know, a study that took place. They came up with a new technique on fixing the amputation site to augment it, to make it work better with the prosthesis. They could take this a lot farther. You know, this was the first step that they took. Now, it was novel, absolutely. Like, they just completely broke new ground here. But they clearly are onto the absolute right direction to go in.
Yeah.
Again, there is an amputation site, meaning that it's going to still have pressure pain and all of the things that they have to do, you know, because you're putting weight on a part of your body that wasn't meant to support weight, right?
But they're doing that anyway if they're wearing prosthesis.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, that's not a change.
No. What I'm saying, though, is like they're still dealing with an amputation. They're still dealing with the normal things that people have to deal with. This isn't like replacing their leg and everything's good and they're all good to go now. Like it's still a thing that they strap to their body.
But it seems like this would reduce, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but does this have the dual benefit of almost being like a very high-tech mirror therapy where it would reduce phantom limb pain because they feel like the limb is actually an extension of their body?
Oh, it sounds like it would get rid of it.
I don't know about getting rid of it, but because, you know, the way the mirror test works is you're looking at it and that makes you think, you know, it tricks your brain.
Yeah.
But if you're feeling it in this way, maybe you could then, I don't know, scratch your leg or you could do the things that you might need to do to relieve that pain.
They also said their future work that they're going to do, they're going to try to have more tactile information sent back to the brain, which is great. I mean, look, we want people to be thinking out of the box and to try these crazy ideas because every once in a while, like they pan out and something incredible happens.
Yeah. So sensors on the bottom of the feet or like, yeah, I could see a lot more information coming up.
It's definitely hopeful. I mean, if I were an amputee, I would want to be on this immediately. You know, it sounds to me like it solves a lot of the problems that these people are suffering from. And, you know, I mean, I can't, the sci-fi geek in me is like, you know, we're one step closer to having, like, you know, at some point they're going to make something and it'd be like, this is even better than a human leg. You know, right,
yeah,
Bob?
Yeah, baby. No.
Transhumanism.
But very good. Sir. You know, MIT, again, knocking it out of the park. Like, just wonderful work that they're doing.
Well, it's a great proof of concept. You know, I was very interested in the idea that doing this kind of approach where the user is affecting the function of the robotic limb, even with just a little bit of sensory feedback, performs better than using AI, which is basically learning, this is how people move their legs when they walk, and now we're going to replicate that movement. Because again, it kind of makes sense when you think back on it. It's like, yeah, so that even though that would work, the person would still feel like there's a robot attached to them, right? Rather than, this is my leg, I'm moving it, I'm controlling it. So this approach does seem better. And I agree, you know, if this is just the beginning, you could certainly imagine just iterating this to when you do the amputation, you do it with this in mind. You know, like now we're going to modify it. We're going to almost do it at the same time, like integrate, you know, the amputation with the prosthesis. That's one procedure.
Or you customize the prosthesis based on the available undamaged tissue.
Right.
Like these nerves are preserved. These are going to be the things that we connect and we maximize.
And we have to note this is below the knee amputation, not above the knee amputation.
Yeah.
Below the knee amputations are a lot easier to deal with because you have a knee.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And these people had the tibialis and gastroc muscle available. Usually that's the flap that you make, right? You know, when you're the cushion at the bottom. So that was already there. But in any case, this wouldn't necessarily apply to every amputee, right? The one other thing you didn't bring up, Jay, that's I think an important aspect of this. Lower extremities are a lot more difficult than upper extremities for prosthetic limbs. And the reason is that just neurologically, it's more complicated, right? Upper extremities, it's basically mostly voluntary control, right? But when you're walking, it's this weird mix of reflex, spinal reflex, subcortical walking reflexes, and voluntary control. And getting that mixture just right is what was very challenging, even for like the AI-driven prosthetic limbs. And that's what this does better, is integrate those different levels of neurological control that are happening when you're walking. Right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that's actually, you know, why this is such a huge step forward, because this is working in a leg, you know, with walking. That's what.
But as you mentioned, it's working in a leg that still had a lot of intact.
Well, yes. They're picking the low-hanging fruit, but
exactly.
Still.
Like the gastrocnemius is your calf, you know? It's like the, and it connects to your Achilles. Like, it does a lot of work in your leg.
They were also reporting that the feeling of putting the prosthetic toes, like, on a staircase and going up, it felt completely natural, where previously it just didn't feel like it was a part of their body. And now, like, it just seems more natural to them.
Yeah,
like,
it crossed over some kind of, you know, barrier in terms of closing that sensory motor feedback loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Thanks, Jay.
Yep.
Kara, there's a couple of interesting stories about our ancestors, our humanoid ancestors.
Indeed. So I'm going to start with an, I guess, older story. I'm going to talk a little bit about a first documented instance of Down syndrome in a Neanderthal. And I have to say that, okay, so the article, real quick, is called The Child Who Lived, Down Syndrome Among Neanderthals, ? And it was published in Science Advances, Anthropology. When I was, I tend to use a reader sometimes when I'm prepping for SGU because it's like on a very busy day. So I'll have the article in front of me, but then I'll have my phone read the article to me. And it kept saying Neanderthal. That's how it was pronouncing the word Neanderthal.
Oh,
mean dirtle, because that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, right.
Wow. And I was like, oh no, this is very distracting. So I will not be talking about Neanderthals. I'll be talking about Neanderthals. And they, a group of scientists in Spain, they dubbed a little girl. What do I call it? I hate calling it a specimen. Like, she was a person, you know? So they dubbed her remains Tina. And they found out that Tina was around 6 years old, and Tina had a pathology in her inner ear that is associated with Down syndrome. So in they did a lot of cool things in this study. They used some really interesting imaging techniques to look at the inner ear and compare that to typical anatomy. They were able to see that this congenital pathology, which is associated with Down syndrome, often results in hearing loss and vertigo. And so using those scans, they discover that. Then you add to that that they were able to kind of age this individual. And they said, okay, this is the first time that we've seen this type of pathology, which is associated with Down syndrome. This individual lived to the age of 6. This is potentially the first example of something very interesting in among the Neanderthal fossil record. So there have been previous studies that have shown that Neanderthals were able to care for and support individuals who were, let's say, vulnerable, like either they were injured or they had a severe illness or elderly. Yeah. And sometimes with congenital abnormalities and things of that nature that would require care. Actually, I shouldn't have said congenital. That is not true. Sometimes with abnormalities, that would have required care. But every example that they found historically up until Tina were not in children. And so a lot of the sort of anthropologic, hypotheses around this was, okay, so this is cool. We can see that Neanderthals are cooperative. We can see that they're capable of caring for individuals who require care. Were they doing it as some sort of a quid pro quo? Like, I scratch your back, you scratch my back. I help you in this way, you help me in that way. But the fact that they found the remains of a 6-year-old kind of changed their narrative a little bit. And so some of the researchers directly involved in the study are saying that this may be, and I'm going to caveat, I'm going to say may, because it also, you know, it's an interpretation. It may be the first example of Neanderthals providing purely altruistic care, right? Because you're not really going to get much from a 6-year-old in terms of like contributing to the kin or contributing to the group's hunting capability or, you know, whatever the sort of positive outcome from behavior would be. Really, this is a 6-year-old child who had needs, who probably couldn't hear and very likely wasn't able to walk very well or stand up very well without extreme dizziness. And so this is an individual and also potentially some of the other things that come along with Down syndrome. So this is an individual in the community that would have required caretaking, and she lived to be 6, which shows that she was cared for. And so that's pretty, it's a pretty interesting takeaway. Obviously, it does require some assumptions, but I don't know. It doesn't sound like it's outside of the realm of possibility. What do you guys think?
Well, I think the fact that she was six cuts both ways, because I wonder, like, how dramatically different was it from just caring for any kid? You know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
if she lived to adulthood, that would have been way more impressive.
And then it becomes the double-edged sword of, well, yeah, maybe they would have been able to show that that specific pathology had to be congenital, even in adulthood, or maybe I don't know if there's an acquired version of that. But yeah, you're right. If this child had lived much longer, it would have shown increased, I guess, evidence of that type of altruism. Although, yeah, in some ways, I think it's a little bit unsafe, or it's a little bit unfair to say that an adult individual with Down syndrome and, yes, hearing loss and, yes, pretty bad vertigo wouldn't have been able to contribute to the society in some form or fashion. Of course they would have. They may have been able to produce tools, or they may have been, you know, there may have been plenty of things that.
But isn't there evidence? I know there's evidence from, like, Cro-Magnon, you know, man, but I thought it was back to Neanderthal, of, like, people who survived really debilitating injuries. Like, they had broken legs that were healed, and that would have made it impossible for them to walk.
Yes, there is historical evidence of individuals with severe debilitating injuries that really shows good evidence that people within the group cared for those individuals. And so that really was their question. But was that person previously an elder? Was that person somebody who had a lot of knowledge and wisdom that they were passing on? Did they want to protect them and care for them because of what they contributed to the group? And so the argument here is, how much is a six-year-old really contributing to the group? But you're right, Steve. Yeah. It's an interesting question. How much is any six-year-old contributing?
Yeah.
Except for the potential that they would grow up, right? And that they would be able to contribute. I also am super curious, and I don't know what the evidence of this looks like. I didn't do this deep a dive. How quickly were young Neanderthal children weaned? How fast were they already starting? Because I have a feeling that they were quicker to mature. And that maybe a six-year-old child, although probably still dependent, may have been more independent than a six-year-old, you know, human child in 2024.
It's an interesting question. We don't know, obviously.
Yeah, it's hard to know. And so there's another study that's sort of not really in the same vein, but related, that was published in Nature just today, called Narrative Cave Art in Indonesia by 51,200 years ago. And this is also kind of a new dating of something that we previously had identified. This is art, cave art, rock art, in an Indonesian cave in Sulawesi. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, so I apologize, where the scientists used a new approach. It's a type of uranium series analysis, looking at the deposits of calcite that were inside of those limestone caves. They used a new approach, something called laser ablation U-series imaging, to redate some of the things that had previously been dated. And when they redated them, they found out that they were older, and they were able to make a more accurate assessment of the age of these, I don't want to call them drawings, these motifs, they call them in the article. So a minimum age of 50.2 thousand years ago, plus or minus 2.2 thousand years. So 4,000 years older than previously thought. And then they also found another site nearby with a minimum age of 53.5 plus or minus 2.3 thousand years. So that moves that date older. At least, because it could be even older, but at least 51,200 years ago, there is what they call narrative composition. So these are human-like figures and pig-like figures that are engaging together. And so they're calling this the earliest known example of visual storytelling in the world. Because even though there is Neanderthal cave art, there's cave art going before modern humans, it was not apparently representational. It wasn't telling a story. You didn't have characters interacting with one another. And so, and you didn't have, like, these anthropomorphic figures and animals doing something together. And, you know, the researchers, they kind of talk a lot about how this may be a fundamental part of human evolution, the ability to abstract, the ability to pass on narratives, to tell stories. And we don't see that in Neanderthal art. We just see kind of these individual concrete etchings. So this is really interesting because it pushes it back even farther than we thought. And perhaps maybe there's even older ones out there that have yet to be seen.
Cool.
Yeah.
Why do they keep calling that art the pig? Right, there was a pig. They kept saying a warty pig.
It's a type of pig. It's a warty pig.
Okay, I don't see any warts on it. What's going on?
Yeah, I think that's the name. It's actually
like
got
a warthog.
A name beyond that,
right.
It's called a It's called a Sus celebensis, which is a warty pig. That's the name of the pig. And also, there were some Bubalis, which were dwarf buffaloes. They called them Anoas. And so warty pigs and Anoas were present in this representational art. Pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Thanks, Kara. All right, Evan, tell us about this festival fail. You got caught up in this, huh?
I got caught up in it. I certainly did. This is our 20th year of producing The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And for the first time in that span, I'm directly involved in a news item.
Nice.
I have a firsthand account of what the hell happened here for the first time ever. This is amazing. Yeah, I and my family, we are the victims of a scam and perhaps an outright fraud. Yep. The news item has made statewide news here in Connecticut as well as Massachusetts, along with national and international notoriety, especially in the live music industry. Several magazines and online blogs and other things have picked this up. Now, it's a topic I don't think we've really covered directly on the SGU before. And I really like the opportunity to get a chance to talk about something different. Now, Kara, mm-hmm. you and I, and I'm sorry for invoking your name here, but I happen to know this about you. We love documentaries about Firefest.
Yes,
right?
We do.
And I know it's this, you know, it was a terrible thing and all. But at the same time, we have a good laugh with it because...
Oh, it's such a Schadenfreude moment. Everything about Firefest was just... It was like Tiger King. It just hit right at the right time. You know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Totally. And against, you know, a lot of privileged people who, you know, basically could afford to be scammed out of this stuff. But if you don't remember, though, Fire Festival, a fraudulent luxury music festival... organized by Billy McFarland, remember that guy, and his cohort was American rapper Ja Rule. They created it with the intent of promoting their Fyre app for booking music talent. And this was back in, 2017 is when it took place. And it was supposed to be a festival out in the Bahamas. And it was a total failure. People got out there and actually no festival took place whatsoever. People were swindled. And
it was a fraud.
Yeah,
it wasn't
fraud.
Just that they
right.
failed. They just didn't. Yeah,
Fyre fraud is ultimately what it became known as. And the next year, McFarlane pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud to defraud investors and ticket holders, and a second count to defraud a ticket vendor. And 6 years in prison, $26 million. So I think of all the infamous concert festival disasters, Fyre is probably the one that's most on people's minds. There have been other ones, though, plenty of them. Altamont in 1969, Woodstock 1999, Glastonbury 2005, and Astroworld Festival 2021. That's just to name a few. And those were cases where people died, you know, and many more were injured and there was damage and destruction as far as the eye can see in some of these cases. So the festival that my daughter Rachel and I attended this past Friday was called, here in Connecticut, was called Capulet Festival. And this is the third year that they're running this festival. And it features a very respectable lineup of metal and metalcore bands. And among them certainly was August Burns Red, which was the reason Rachel wanted to go, because that's her favorite group. So we decided to buy tickets for the entire festival. This was earlier in the year, around February. We decided this was going to be our summer trip, you know, kind of instead of, you know, going away to another state somewhere for a week or taking a flight somewhere. We decided this was going to be our summer trip. Fortunately, right here in Connecticut, nice and easy, happening on June 28th, June 29th, and June 30th at an outdoor venue that can accommodate 12,000 people. You know, respectable-sized festival. We go ahead and we bought the premier ticket packages. And those are the ones that give you the VIP meet and greets with several of the headlining bands, and you get the premier parking and special access to areas of the festival that other people, don't have access to. You get a campsite if you wanted to come and bring your tent or your trailer or your camper. The cost was about $750 per ticket. But there was a lineup of over 50 bands over a three-day period. And the amenities, that's actually a reasonable deal. So that's what we did. We bought those tickets, two of them. So June 28th, right? First day of the festival. On June 27th, 24 hours before the start of the event is when the facade began to come down. Rumors online started to swirl that the festival would not be taking place at the original site for 12,000 people. Oh, no. It was going to be moved to a small concert hall in Hartford, Connecticut, with a maximum capacity of 1,200 people.
Whoa.
Yep.
So that's like science or fiction difference.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
At least an order of magnitude
less. Yep. First thing I did, what did I do? I ran to the website when I heard this for Capulet Fest. And I'm reading. There's no changes. All the original information is there. And I go to their Facebook page. Same thing. Nothing official. No official word. This is just some rumors being passed around. Okay. I sent an email as fast as I could to the people, to the festival organizers for an update. And then not long after I sent my email, the official word did come down about the venue change. And sure enough, the power of social media, that meant the floodgates opened. There was talk of cancellations. First, it was some of the supporting acts, and then some of the main artists were being rumored to have pulled out of this festival. I mean, this is 24 hours before it's ready to go, and we're finding this out. Oh, my gosh. Fans spreading information via back channels, sharing text threads that they have with some of the members of some of these bands. You know, they'll actually take a screenshot of their phone with the text thread, right, and post that onto Facebook and say, well, here's what the lead singer of this band is saying. They're not going, right? That the thing is falling apart. Yeah, the before opening day, you know, and basically it opened up at that point. Once the crack formed, it came spilling out, drinking from the fire hose, as it was. I spent the whole Thursday night just reading updates about what the heck was going on here. Was there actually going to even be a festival at this point? Oh, my gosh. Well, Rachel's band, August Burns Red, they were still going. So we decided, all right, we're going to go. All right, we're going to go, but not without my reservations. Obviously, I had a specific,
so you made reservations.
Oh well, you know, I had a specific fear about this because the rumor was circulating that the concert was way undersold. There were about 3,000 tickets sold, right, for a 12,000 person venue, right. So clearly, they didn't raise enough money to pay for all of the original stuff that they wanted to do. But they sold 3,000 tickets, and now we're going into this 1,200. Capacity Oof. Theater, right? How's that going to work? And I wasn't the only one really asking those questions. Other people were concerned about this. You know, you go up there, you get squeezed into this venue that can't hold 3,000 people, and it's an angry crowd of people, frankly, to begin with, who are pissed off that all these changes are happening last second and some of their favorite artists are no longer performing at this thing. But we decided to go. We would give it a chance, and if we felt it was too dicey, we were going to just leave after that. Because it's only Hartford, Connecticut, not too much for us. Say that to the other people who actually drove from like North Carolina or flew in Oof. From Florida or Wisconsin and so many other people. You know, I felt much worse for them. But, you know, those fears wound up being unfounded. By my estimate on Friday, there were about 500 people at the show. So one of two things happened. The thing was way undersold, even to a lower extent that I had, you know, understood it, you know, where they were saying maybe 3,000 people, or just people were so mad that they decided to just forfeit the damn thing and walk away from it. Right?
What about getting a refund?
Yeah, so refunds, right? If you go to their website, obviously they have a policy in which they say there will be no refunds issued for things like exchanges or, you know, bands dropping out and these sorts of things is basically what they said. But I will get to that because at the end of this news item is when, you know, basically some other people come along and say, nah, that doesn't hold water. I'll get to that, Jay. We went there Friday. I'll tell you what happened. We went there Friday night. this venue has two stages, you know, a small room that holds 200 people with a small stage and the main room, which holds about 1,000 people. And they alternated the stages, right? About 9 acts, I think, wound up performing on Friday. Okay, fine. But it was a cluster, right? They didn't know where anything was going to – where were they going to put the vendors, right? Where were people going to drive their campers, right? And you know, into middle of downtown – you know, basically downtown Hartford. It's not going to work, right? So there was all kinds of – things going on in which it was a total cluster, and everyone was certainly really mad about it.
Why did they lose the original venue?
The reason ultimately why they lost the original venue is because they did not secure the correct insurance for the festival.
Whoa!
And it's called the Thompson Motor Speedway in here in Connecticut. And when they couldn't provide it with 24 hours, they basically said, "Okay, you lose rights, and you're not coming in. We can't do this." Right? They're not gonna take it on the chin for them. And I don't even know why they really let it go that far. But yeah, they couldn't get the insurance is what I heard. So, all right, Friday night happens, right? Really weak turnout. Everyone's kind of down. And the next day, this is Saturday, June 29th. It was a lackluster day. I think about 12 or 13 artists performed. The last act on the small stage was performing Saturday night. And then what happened is they got cut off. The venue officials stepped in, they cut the mic, and they said, "Everybody out." They're kicking everybody out before the music ended on Saturday night. It was it. It was over right then and there. No completion of the second day of music, and there was going to be nothing on day three. Original rumors was basically saying, "Hey, guys, beware. We think that Sunday is outright canceled." But the promoters were promoting Sunday as Saturday was unfolding. They said, "We're going to have a great lineup on Sunday," because they were still trying to sell more tickets, even though they seemed to have known that Sunday was a total bust.
Oh, wow.
Now, the reason that the venue stepped in and cut it and stopped the show was because the venue did not get paid. They were promised that they were going to get paid, and they did not get paid. And so they pulled the plug in the middle, basically, of the event. And that was it. So, I mean, look, some okay things about, you know, nobody got hurt. There were no injuries, physical injuries that I'm aware of any kind. Nobody died, right? So I don't think you can put this on a list of other festival disasters in which, you know, people actually, you know, lost their lives in these massive crowds and things. But that did not stop the people from being so mad, so mad. You should have read the social media going on during this whole thing. It was something.
Well, do you think that does this qualify as like a Ponzi? Do you think that what they did was, expect all these ticket sales to pay for things that they hadn't paid for?
Well, and this is when we get to the Attorney General of the state of Connecticut, who on July 2nd, not only announced made a public announcement, right? He had a press conference as well about this very thing. His name is Attorney General William Tong, and here's how the letter reads. Today, July 2nd, he's opened an investigation into Capulet Entertainment following dozens of consumer complaints. It's up to hundreds of now, by the way, regarding the abrupt collapse of the three-day Capulet 2024 Music Festival. Here's what he says. We've received dozens, now hundreds, of complaints from frustrated ticket holders. Fans paid hundreds of dollars and booked campsites, overnight accommodations, traveled for this three-day festival. This is not what they got. They need to explain, the Capulet Entertainment people need to explain exactly why things went wrong and provide prompt refunds to every consumer that they let down. So an official investigation has been opened by the Attorney General of the state of Connecticut looking into this. So I definitely registered my complaint. You know, there's an official form. You go to their website and you fill out and you provide them with all the details of what you've got. Plus, they obviously had no idea that I was going to be there and that I'd be talking about this on my podcast concerning skepticism. So,
Evan, I wonder how much of this was just incompetence.
Yes, that's what they're going to investigate to determine if this person was, you know, just right incompetent, or did he try to perpetrate a fraud from the get-go?
Well, and at what point is incompetence fraud?
Or did it evolve into a fraud?
That's what I think. It evolved into a fraud. They were in over their head. It wasn't going well. They were underselling tickets. And then the fraud kicked in to cover their asses.
Right.
Rather than do the right thing, whatever that would have been.
Pulling the plug a month ago or whatever, when you realized you didn't have the sales and the money to back this entire thing up, you should have shut the whole thing down. And I think peoples and artists and even vendors would have been disappointed but understood. But certainly to let it go to this extent, now you've got people who are, you know, frothing and lighting torches and carrying pitchforks and wanting, you know, justice done in this particular case. And yeah, I think it did slide into the territory of fraud, which if they're able to prove it, I mean, I don't know how this guy, the promoter's name is Esteban Vega. I don't know what he and his lawyers are going to try to work out here. I would plead basically to plead this thing, because if he goes, you know, if he gets brought up into a trial on a fraud charge, that you're talking jail time.
Well, and I don't want to get into the legal weeds here, but does fraud require intentionality?
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, why is it legal, or is it legal, to say, I want to do a thing that I can't afford to do, and I'm going to hope that the money that the people who are going to come to the thing will pay me will cover the thing I plan to do without having done the appropriate financials and having, you know, checked all the boxes? Like, it seems... I guess that's American, you know, entrepreneurship, but it's
fake it till you make
very
it kind
dangerous.
Of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. It seems like you need to have enough money in the bank to cover all your bills. Otherwise, you're just step one of a Ponzi scheme.
And people thought that this person, because this is the third year he was doing it, knew what he was doing. This wasn't, you know, he's not a total rookie.
Unless it finally caught up to him. He's been paying his debts with the new money that's supposed to be paying for the things today, but he's paying for yesterday with today.
And there's the Ponzi part aspect that you brought up. And, you know, thank goodness our attorney general is actually going to now be investigating this. And we will eventually find out exactly how it happened, why it happened, and if there's going to be any sort of, you know, refunds issued and people made whole by this, and if anybody is criminally liable for anything. But I was caught up right in the middle of it all. It was unfolding right before my eyes. It was like, wow. Oh,
but it is a good example of how incompetence bleeds into fraud. You know what I mean? And like as Kara was saying, this is why you need regulations too. You know, and I know we've done events and we're like, oh my god, we got to get this insurance and that, and it's burdensome. It's absolutely burdensome, but there's a reason for it, because otherwise, you know, jerk offs like this, you know, try to pull something off, they fail, and then you know, at the end of the day, hundreds, maybe thousands of people get defrauded, even if it wasn't the original intention. That's what happens.
And this is a service. It's not, it's a luxury. It's not a necessity. If it's too burdensome for you to do the job right, you're not the person to be doing this job.
Right.
Agreed.
Right? Don't take it on if you're not willing to do the work. And I don't know. It's like you think about Elizabeth Holmes. I think that's a perfect example. It was incompetence that turned into fraud. She legit thought she had a good idea that was working. And once she realized it wasn't, she covered her tracks.
Yeah.
And I think you see that story a lot.
Sure. Sure.
Some fraudsters set out to commit fraud from the get-go, but I think a lot of fraudsters, they end up committing fraud because they get in over their heads.
You know, because you brought up Elizabeth Holmes, in some of the interviews and the stories I've seen in documentaries about Elizabeth Holmes, is that when she did bring this initially to people, there were some that told her, this is not right. You're not going to, this can't happen.
Some people told her it's impossible. And others said it's a great idea. Let's do it.
Right, right.
And so, it was the people with equivalent credentials, sadly.
Sure.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, whenever there's an update on this, I'll be sure to give it to you.
Ev, are you going to try to get your money back?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, if there is money to be gotten back, that's the other part of this, Jay, is like, what kind of assets does this person have? I looked him up. I believe it's a sole member LLC, and it basically has no protection against them going after his personal assets. If he has a house or something, he might have to sell it. But
is there a ventish insurance that you can get? Like, if this goes a bust, like, it covers any liability? Or, I mean, I don't know.
My guess is yes.
Or maybe if you bought it with your credit card. Like, I think some credit cards have protections built into
it. But I mean, like, insurance for the event operators. Like, you know?
Right.
You have to take out, quote unquote, event insurance. I don't know.
Maybe, but he didn't even take out insurance on
apparently not.
Evan, if you bought your tickets using a credit card, go to your credit card.
Yeah, I would try that too.
I could definitely try that. That would be a good step. Yep.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Bob, tell us about Kugelblitz black holes. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes. An exotic but theoretical object called a Kugelblitz essentially a black hole formed from ridiculously intense light instead of actual mass, has been shown to be most likely an impossible object because quantum mechanics says so. Bottom line. So yeah, this paper was accepted for physical review letters. The main guy behind it is theoretical physicist Eduardo Martin Martinez and colleagues. All right, so what the hell is a Kugelblitz? A Kugelblitz is a gion. Well, what's a gion? It goes back to the famous theoretical physicist John Archibald Wheeler. Quite a guy that John was. Really, really amazing guy. Probably best known for popularizing the term black hole, but he also introduced the concept and the word wormhole. Stephen Hawking called Wheeler the hero of the black hole story, and so much more. Look this guy up. He's really was an amazing scientist. Wheeler came up with the concept of a gion in 1955. In a physical review paper. Gion stands for gravitational electromagnetic entity. And the idea flows from general relativity and its idea of mass and energy being essentially manifestations of the same thing, right? Mass energy. There's the whole E equals MC squared and all that, right? That's all involved. So, and here's the critical bit. If a giant star could collapse and concentrate so much mass that its gravity wraps space-time completely around itself, becoming a black hole, then so could energy itself because energy and mass are kind of interchangeable. So heat or radiation or light, they should all be able to form a black hole as well, as long as you have enough of it in a small enough place. So that's kind of what general relativity was saying about that. So nowadays we call it not a gion but a Kugelblitz, which is German for ball lightning. And it really is fascinating. I've read a bit about it. And you obviously can't just dismiss predictions from general relativity, right? I mean, you can't dismiss them out of hand. Its track record is too ridiculously good. Hello, gravitational waves. So Kugelblitzes have even seeped into popular culture. Steve, if you saw the show Umbrella Academy, I think it was season 3, there was a guest star, and it was a Kugelblitz in that show for a lot of episodes. Of course, it had some artistic license. More subtly, Star Trek Next Gen had an episode called Timescape, where a Romulan warbird's power source was revealed to be an artificial quantum singularity, almost certainly a Kugelblitz. So, and there's actually been real discussion over the years about how advanced civilizations might be able to create a Kugelblitz, and as a power source, since small ones tinier than a proton could theoretically emit literally petawatts of usable energy. They would be amazing if they existed. So those were the good old days. Then this damn research came out, like, oh, crap. The researchers looked at Kugelblitzes through a quantum mechanical lens, just like Hawking did for black holes. When Hawking did it decades ago, he famously concluded that black holes can, in fact, emit radiation. Hawking radiation. So that was obviously a really huge discovery. So when theoretical physicist Eduardo Martin Martinez and his colleagues did the same thing, they looked at Kugelblitzes through this quantum mechanical lens, they found that there was a quantum effect there that hadn't been identified before, and it was the deal breaker. According to quantum electrodynamics, incredibly famous and also very verified theory. When light interacts in such an extreme way, particles and antiparticles like electrons and positrons just appear and they can bleed away the energy. It's like, oh, that's basically the deal killer right there. The researchers say in their paper, we show that it's not possible to concentrate enough light to precipitate the formation of an event horizon. We argue that the dissipative quantum effects coming from the self-interaction of light are enough to prevent any meaningful buildup of energy that could create a black hole in any realistic scenario. So it turns out that enough of these particles are created, these antiparticles, that soak up the energy essentially, and then they escape, and that prevents any chance of a black hole forming. And there's even a name for it. It's called the Schwinger effect. And this has been confirmed in the lab and even in neutron star observations. So the confidence level is very, very high. That their conclusions are true. I don't know how you would calculate that with something as theoretical as a Kugelblitz, but they're very confident because of their confidence in quantum electrodynamics. Okay. And when they say that it can't happen in any realistic scenario, they really mean it. Their calculations showed that even laser light intensities 10 to the friggin' 50th times more powerful than state-of-the-art lasers could not overcome this effect and create a Kugelblitz. 10 to the 50th, that's 100 quindecillion. That's also 100 trillion, 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 trillion. So even something that powerful could not create the create this black hole, because the particles and antiparticles would just bleed away the energy that you would need to make that happen. The most luminous objects, among the most luminous objects in the universe, quasars, are far too dim to create one. They even looked at Kugelblitzes that were incredibly small. Like maybe we can create a really, really tiny Kugelblitz, 1/100 of a quintillionth of a nanometer. And then they also calculated all the way up to 100 million meters, and no dice. You can't create one even within that range. And if you tried to go even smaller or bigger than that, a huge range, they still say it would still be very, very unlikely. So not looking good. So they throw us – there is a tiny loophole. They threw us a little bit of a bone in their paper. The researchers say that there is tiny hope that one could have been created. But don't get your hopes up here. Apparently, there's a possibility that in the first millionth of a second after the Big Bang, during the inflationary period, it might have been possible that energy collapsed into a Kugelblitz to form primordial black holes, which you've mentioned on the show many times. That would be cool. But unfortunately, a black hole – made from mass would look the same to us as one made from light. So yeah, thanks a lot, guys. Even if there is one out there, and there might be one out there, these primordial black holes that have survived for billions of years, we would never even be able to tell the difference because they would look the same. So all right, whatever. So bummer for me. It's kind of depressing because there are things that theoretical things that you could have created with a Kugelblitz. You could have, you know, like I said, you could have made a power source. An amazing power source. People have come up with ideas to power spaceships using these artificial singularities. That really could have been amazing, far better than even any fusion spaceship that you could imagine. But looks like if you want a little singularity, you're probably going to have to make it by throwing mass together or traveling to one. So that sucks.
Another one bites the dust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another theoretical advanced technology that probably was never true is definitely not true.
Yeah, but hey man, general relativity predicted it, so I was like, all right. Okay.
That's a
damn good track record, but this one, no. Einstein, you messed up.
Yeah. What a failure he's been.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy.
That's a zombie high in ecstasy.
Yeah, it's like a Tasmanian devil having sex.
Yeah. That's your guess, Kara?
It had sex vibes. It had wild animal sex vibes.
You have a vivid imagination.
You tend to think noisies are animals.
It did, actually. It had the rhythm.
It's very animalistic and
rhythmic.
Episodic. Yeah, rhythmic, exactly.
Somebody definitely wrote in something like that, Kara. So let me read these for you.
That's what it sounds like.
I got so many guesses this week. So listener named Emily Markwell said, the Tasmanian devil, right? Right. Here we go, Kara. My partner Andrew was a huge fan and avid listener. We are currently driving back down to the Australian East Coast from Byron to Bellingen and love arguing over what the noisy is. We hope we are right this week. You are incorrect, but Kara agrees with you. Another person wrote in, Richard Smith. He said, this week's noisy sounds a bit like a bunch of Tasmanian devils sharing a meal.
Wow.
Which it's interesting because people are hearing this Tasmanian devil. So I tried to find a noisy of a Tasmanian devil. They don't make this noise at all. They don't sound like this. Another listener named Zachary Dorma said, a Cybertruck windshield wiper that needs recalling. I thought that was so clever.
Burn.
So clever. Listen, it does kind of sound like a really crappy windshield wiper. Listen. It totally does. Come on. It's not it, but you get props. Another listener named John McDermott, he said, John McDermott here from Hawaii. My guess is the sound of the mother's heartbeat from a baby's perspective. I thought that was a wonderful guess. That is not correct. But that's a cool guess. Another listener named Shane Hillier wrote in, okay, I got this one for sure. It's a bicycle-powered butter churner. And whoa. I've seen those. They exist. He's not joking. And I labeled this as the close guess because there was a keyword in there that he used. The keyword was bicycle. We have one last guess. Guess why I put it in here. This is from Peter. He said, sawing an ice fishing hole, jerky, question mark. Mm-hmm. So any reference to the jerky boys, you're going to get me. All right, guys. Nobody won, but this one has something to do with a bike. So tell me what it is.
It's a flat tire.
It's a flat tire.
Oh, that's there it? You go.
Good, it's, good it's rolling a bike with a completely flat tube over asphalt. Huh. Now, I've heard this noise as a kid. I've heard this noise as a kid. I recognized it when the listener sent it in.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that more often than Tasmanian devils doing it.
But it definitely has it has its own sound. There is a scrunching rubber sound in there. Listen. You know, like that. Almost sounds like a Star Wars alien talking. I just thought that was cool. There's everyday sounds around us, weird sounds that many of us would experience that you might not stand out when you hear it, like, you know, a flat tire on a bicycle. But when you hear it up close like this, it has a unique sound profile. And again, I say this all the time, sounds sound like other sounds. It's context is everything when it comes to noisies. Have you guys noticed that?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, absolutely.
All right, guys, I got a new noisy, another fun one for you. This was sent in by a listener named Vigo Telefsen, T-E-L-L-E-F-S-E-N, Telefsen. And that's only his middle name. His last name is Wivstad. He's going to email me. I guarantee it. Dude, I'm sorry, Vigo.
You got to include the phonetics, man.
Vigo, my friend, Vigo.
You know who you're
if I had
with.
Vigo as a friend, every time I see him in person, I'd go, Vigo! Definitely. All right, here we go, guys. Wait for it. So many clues. Wow. So many clues in there. It sounded like so many things. If you guys think you know what this week's noisy is, if you heard something cool, you work in weird places, right? There's got to be people out there that work in all sorts of different factories and everything. Come on. There's noisies all around you. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, I've got so much to say to you right now.
Hit me.
One of them is... I've been asking our listeners, if you are interested in supporting the work that we do, the Skeptic's Guide has been going on for 20 years. We started in 2005. We have been doing this program for 20 years. We are going to be recording our 1000th episode in August of this year. If you enjoy the work that we do, if you think there's any value to the work that we do, please seriously consider becoming a patron of the show. You would enable us to do more, reach more people. There's so many things that we'd like to do that we can't just because we don't have the time and material to do it. So becoming a patron can really help. And also, if you do become a patron, you can join our wonderful community of awesome friends. They are the super friends. You can join our Discord. And of course, you know, then you can meet them in person at the next Nauticon, which is going to be happening in 2025. More details coming soon.
Nice.
I'm just trying to get past the current show that we're doing, because it's a big one. I got so much stuff I'm doing. But go to the patreon.com/skepticsguide to learn more about becoming a patron of the show. If you are interested, every week we send out an email. It has everything that we've done over the past week. You could just join that on our website, theskepticsguide.org. There's a button on there for you. You could also give our show a rating or tell a friend. Both of those things can help new people find the show, which would be wonderful. We have tickets available. We have two shows coming up that tickets are available at. We will be doing a extravaganza. This is our stage show. This is a show where we teach you how you cannot trust your senses. And there's a lot of improv comedy bits in there. We're getting a lot of wonderful feedback on the last show that we did. It was a great freaking show. It was so much fun. So if you're interested, you can come out. You can go to the website, theskepticsguide.org. There's a button there for the extravaganza tickets that are happening on August 17th. And the 1,000th SGU show. There are not many tickets left.
Oh, boy.
I had to cut tickets off because I wanted to give people, everybody, a wonderful view of the stage and the screen and everything that we're doing. So I decided to whack back the numbers a little bit. So right now there's not many left, but there's still some tickets left. You can go to theskepticsguide.org. There's a button there. That show will be happening on August 18th. Yes, Kara will be there. People are asking.
Oh, yeah, I'll be there.
Will Kara be there? Everybody wants to know where Kara is, what she's doing, what she had for dinner. I don't tell anybody anything about you, Kara.
Except that I'll be there.
She will be at the show, though. You can ask her yourself. And there's something else I decided to do. I was talking to Ian today. You know, we get emails from listeners where they tell us, you know, hey, I really appreciate the show, you know, because of you, blah, like something happened in their life. And it made me think, you know, we have our 1,000th show coming up. I thought it would be cool if you're interested, there's a button on the homepage now where you can click it and you can tell us if the show had an impact on you in any way. I'm looking to find some interesting ones that I could read during the 1,000th show. It's important to us to hear these types of things because we basically operate in a vacuum here. You know, 99% of the time, it's just the five of us here talking to each other. You know, we're not doing that many live shows a year, so we don't really get out and get to talk to people as often as we'd like. And I just think it would be great, like, if the show had an impact on you or helped you make a decision or, you know, anything along those lines, please do drop us a quick note. Just understand that I might play it on the 1,000th show. So if you want to leave your name out or personal details or anything, but that's that. So you can go to the SGU, theskepticsguide.org. Again, that's our website. Please join us into the future. It's going to be a rough one, guys. We need critical thinking now more than ever. I tried to clone Steve. It failed. Mm-hmm. It didn't work.
Miserably.
It was a failure. Yeah. I wanted to make a young Steve to go on to the next generation. We don't have the technology. I got close, but I didn't get all the way. So the only other thing you could do is join us in this effort.
Thank you, Jay. Guys, we're going to do a named out logical fallacy.
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay.
This comes from Randy.
Randy says,
is there a term for a pattern of behavior from religious individuals? They seem to be to divorce themselves from the responsibility of convincing others and instead make it a problem within the audience. If your heart wasn't hardened, the proof would be evident. I even see this in texts. The parable of Lazarus has someone asking Abraham for help, convincing his family to believe, and he gets rejected. Randy. Okay, so what Randy's asking is this a logical fallacy? And if so, what is it to say, well, if you don't believe, it's not because the proof is not self-evident or there isn't proof. It's because you have a hardened heart or you lack faith, right?
Oh, so
that's the most common one. You lack faith. Or I've been told personally, you're just blind to the truth of the Bible. That's it. Mm. You're just blind.
Or have you ever had I think this follows the same structure when it's like more of a pseudoscience claim and they're like, you're just not open-minded enough.
Yes. Yes.
Ugh.
Open-minded and lacks faith are basically the equivalent
of
a claim from a logical perspective. So what do you guys think?
I'm so bad at these.
Well,
I can never remember all of the informal ones.
Well, so if you're saying you're having a disagreement with somebody and you're saying that basically you're wrong, but it's because of some negative feature that you have. What is that?
Oh, well, that's an ad hominem.
That's an ad hominem. Yeah. So there's definitely that is in here, right? It's like you lack faith. You aren't open-minded. You are blind, right? And that's the problem here. Not the power of my arguments or the quality of my evidence or the validity of my logic. It's that you are the problem because you are blind or whatever, lack faith. So that's an ad hominem. But there's another thing going on in here, I think.
Is it special pleading?
No, I don't think so.
You know, because it's kind of like, I don't know, like the way I understand it is that it's like making up exceptions when like you can prove that it's not true. It's like, I guess it's not really because it's not like
not
because
really.
The Bible says so. Yeah. Because then that would also be like some appeal to authority stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? And it's not a burden of shifting the burden of proof.
So Randy goes actually on to speculated about it. I didn't want to say because it kind of gives it away. He says he thinks it could be some sort of unstated major premise. And I agree. I think that's in there as well. The unstated major premise is that there is proof, right? Or that there is a solid argument for it. So it's not that unstated, but it's definitely implicit instead of explicit. Like there's the assumption that if you weren't blind, you would be convinced by the evidence, right? Or if you didn't have some kind of failing of faith or open-mindedness or whatever. So again, I think it's mainly an ad hominem, but I think it's feeding into this unstated premise of because the argument that there is proof or there, you know, whatever, that the evidence is convincing or it is compelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sounds good.
But I think the 99% of here is the ad hominem.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm.
And you're right. You're absolutely right, Kara. Yeah. I wrote a whole article about this, that saying that you're not open-minded is exactly like saying you lack faith. It's just...
It makes me so angry.
Yeah.
I get so frustrated when that is the claim.
Yeah. It's also wrong. Yeah, I always like to flip it. It's like, so I'm open to any outcome here. I'm open to this being real, to it being not real. I will follow the evidence wherever it leads. I'm just doing that. I'm following evidence,
exactly.
Evidence and logic. You're closed-minded because you're closed-minded to the possibility that you're wrong. You're closed to the possibility that this is self-deception. Or whatever, you know, that there's some alternate explanation. I can't tell you how many times I've had true believers say to me, you'll never convince me that this isn't true. It's like, yeah, you're pretty much admitting that you're closed-minded.
Right.
You know, so in the same breath that they're accusing me of being closed-minded, they go, like, because you'll never convince me. It's like, well, you could convince me. You could, you just are not because the evidence is crap. It's shite.
And it's such a weird mental gymnastic.
Yes.
It's kind of like saying, okay, you're not open-minded enough. And then you're saying, no, I am open-minded. I'm looking at the evidence. The evidence has disproven that. Let's say we're talking about something really obvious, like iridology. The evidence has disproven these claims. And they're like, yeah, but what if you're wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What if
there are unicorns? Yeah, I know.
Exactly. It's like, okay, but what if you're wrong?
We're all wrong, right?
It's
being less wrong by following logic and evidence. Yeah, it's just you're right. It's mental gymnastics.
Yeah,
and it does turn into special pleading at some point. That process leads right to special pleading.
Yeah, because they just keep kind of changing.
Yeah, because you're starting with the answer, so you will. Mm-hmm. This is what you do when you want to maintain the answer. Okay, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Three regular news items. You guys ready?
Ready.
Yep. Item number one. In a sample of almost 10,000 people, smoking was found to correlate with lower personality scores in conscientiousness and agreeableness and higher extroversion scores. That's obviously in the ocean construct, you know, the five personality types. Item number two, researchers find that the standard pasteurization process eliminates 100% of H5N1 bird flu virus from infected milk. That's of active virus. And item number three, a new study finds that introns, non-coding segments of genes, can affect protein folding independent of their effects on splicing. Let me just give you a little background there just to make sure that you know what I'm referring to.
What are you talking about?
Genes, right? A gene codes for a protein.
Yep.
They have exons and introns. The exons are the part that codes for the protein. Introns are bits that are cut out and thrown away. They don't contribute to the final protein. They're non-coding.
You wouldn't call them junk DNA, though.
No, because
that's kind of debunked.
They are. Yeah, they're not junk. They used to be considered junk DNA, but they're not. They're non-coding DNA, but they do affect things, right? They do. I'm not going to get into too much more detail there, but they're non-coding, but not irrelevant. Like, for example, they affect splicing. That's why I had to say that as a caveat, independent of their effects on splicing. All right, Evan, go first.
Well, okay, 10,000 people, smoking was found to correlate with lower personality scores in conscientiousness and agreeableness and higher extroversion scores. Okay. I mean, smoking, there's a ton of chemicals going on in smoke. I'm assuming we're talking about cigarette smoking. You know.
Cigarettes and cigars.
And cigars, okay. So, sure, why wouldn't some of these chemicals that are in these products have an impact along these lines? I don't see that as being unreasonable. The second one about pasteurization. It eliminates 100% of bird flu virus from infected milk. That would be good. I hope that's true. That's a positive one, very, very much so. I mean, sure, you know, but does it? You know, that is a binary one right there. It either is or it isn't. I really hope it is. And then this last one. Oh, boy. Introns, my first introduction to this word, I think, or I've probably read it and didn't know what I was reading. They can affect protein folding independent of their effects on splicing. Well, obviously, this is the one I know. I just don't know anything about this. So I really don't have a sense for it. I have a good sense for number two. I have a decent sense for number one. I got no sense for this last one about the introns. So what will I do? I have to kind of just make a guess here. I will say that the introns, I'll go with the introns ones being the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
This goes from like easy to hard. The first one here about the smokers and the fact that they score lower on conscientiousness and agreeableness. I think that one is science. Researchers, for number two, the researchers find that standard pasteurization process eliminates 100% of H5N1 bird flu. I mean, I don't see why it wouldn't kill 100% of it, because once you get up to a certain temperature, the virus is going to die, and that's it. I'm not sure. I don't know if they treat it chemically. I don't think that they do. I think it's all a matter of pressure and temperature. So I think that one is science. I can't see that they would be, I can't see that that pasteurization process wouldn't be doing that. And then three, the last one here, the one about introns. I mean, you know, this is a toughie because I don't have a good working knowledge of this stuff. So I'm just kind of using my gut here. So we're saying that these non-coding segments of genes can affect protein folding. I don't know why that is significant, meaning that this has to be independent of their effects on splicing.
The introns are already known to affect splicing. What that means is one gene can code for multiple different proteins based on how it gets spliced up, and yeah, that is controlled by the introns. And of course, that would affect folding. Right, if you're splicing if the ultimate protein is spliced from different segments, does that make sense? I mean, the resulting protein would be different, and so therefore it would fold differently. This is saying even without that, like it's the exact same protein, but it's folding differently based upon the introns.
I would have liked to have heard from Kara and Bob.
Sure, me too.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, Evan and I know where we're at. Okay. I am going to deviate from what my gut told me, which was to think this one was the fiction. And I am going to say the milk one is the fiction. I don't know why. There's a thing in there. There's a little doodad in there that makes me think that this one is the fiction. I'm going with that one.
Okay, Kara.
You probably can't answer this, but like for the smoking and the big five, are we talking, is this like a new study?
Yeah.
Because this has been studied a million times. And historically, yeah, I think it's low conscientiousness, agreeableness, high neuroticism, extroversion. What am I leaving out? Openness to new experience. Oh, I don't know.
Smelly breath, is halitosis.
Which one? But yeah, so I don't know why it's only those three that you're mentioning, but they seem to fall in line with historical data, unless the new study shows, no, it's different.
No.
But that's so hard with science or fiction, because when you're like, a study says, well, yeah, any study can say anything. But the literature shows that what you are listing there is science. Researchers find that the standard pasteurization process, 100% is a high bar. are. But I have a feeling that this one is science because, I don't know, I feel like I've been covering bird flu a lot lately, and we would have heard if a bunch of people were falling ill from drinking milk because we know it's in the milk. But if it's then killed, then who cares if it's in the milk? So I think that one is science. Otherwise, I think we would have more deaths or at least more infections. And then introns affecting protein folding independent of their effects on splicing. Oof. So I know they're removed prior, and I thought that they affected like ribosomes, but I could see there being some sort of indirect effect on protein folding. God, are they all, can they all be science? No.
No.
So I think the devil's going to be in the details with this. My guess is that either this new study actually showed a difference in what previous study shows about smoking, and maybe it's because smoking has changed over the years, and maybe we're seeing, I don't know, lower extroversion scores now or something because it's no longer a social, what do you call it, behavior, or that while introns can affect indirectly protein folding, it's not independent of their effects on slicing. It's a function of their effects on slicing. So it's one, I think it's one of those two things. So I'm going to say it's the intron one that is the fiction, and it's because it's due or related to their effects on splicing.
And Bob?
Yeah, this smoking one kind of makes sense, although I agree with Kara's angle on it. Like, what's new? Maybe it has changed because the culture has changed. Ah, man. Pasteurization, yeah, it makes sense. That seems reasonable to me that pasteurization could impact it. And yeah, we would have probably heard something about it. Probably would have caused a milk panic. Yeah, this intron one, I mean, I could see that there's some subtle influence that we hadn't seen before. But this is the one that's the most dodgy. I'm going to have to say, I'll say the intron one's fiction as well.
All right. So you guys are all agreeing on the smoking one. So we'll start there. In a sample of almost 10,000 people, smoking was found to correlate with lower personality scores in conscientiousness and agreeableness and higher extroversion scores. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yep, this is basically confirming prior studies, Kara.
Okay.
That's why it's like 10,000 people. You know, it's a huge sample.
Yeah.
The neuroticism, lower neuroticism and higher openness was found among cigar smokers only, compared to both cigarette and non-smokers. But
so maybe that is a shift from
It's a little bit of a shift. But conscientiousness and agreeableness being lower and higher extroversion was found in just smoking in general. And the interpretation is that the extroversion one is that it's a social behavior. People do it because it enhances their social interactions. And that conscientiousness, you know, given that basically it's impulsive, it's not really good decision making for their health and whatnot.
It's also not a conscientious thing to do around non-smokers.
Right. And that's where
the
agreeableness comes in, just saying, you're basically a jerk. not surprising. And Evan, it's not that the smoking is causing these personality changes, that these personality changes are causing the smoking, right?
Right.
Or these differences. Oh. That people with these traits are more likely to engage in smoking because they're less conscientious about the health effects in other people. They're less, you know, agreeable in terms of like not being disturbing to other people. They're more interested in the social aspects than they are in the health aspects, you know?
Yeah, the big five are thought to be traits, not states.
Yeah.
So they tend to be persistent throughout the lifespan.
Yeah, they're remarkably persistent. That is
remarkable.
And refractory, refractory to interventions.
Yeah, like you can bump them a little, but yeah.
Right, they could be mitigated, but not changed. There's gonna be anything about it. All right, I guess we'll just take these in order. Researchers find that the standard pasteurization process eliminates 100% of H5N1 bird flu virus from infected milk. Jay, you think this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. Yeah, 100%. That's a really high bar.
Mm-hmm.
But functionally,
but it has to be, right?
Functionally, it means that it was undetectable by whatever mechanism we used to detect it.
Right.
The mechanism that they used to detect it, if you're interested, was PCR, which is very, very sensitive. This one is science. says science.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, 100%.
Because if it was 99%, we would have a crisis.
Well, not necessarily, because the inoculum is low enough that your immune system can handle it. Like, it doesn't
establish an
infection.
I guess, but I don't want to be drinking live.
But you're right. It's certainly reassuring to know that the standard FDA, whatever, pasteurization process leaves no functional virus behind. There were fragments of virus, but not intact. That's why intact functional virus. So, yeah, so that's good to know. And you're right. That's probably why there hasn't been massive H5N1 outbreaks going on.
Thank goodness.
At least in people.
In people, right.
So, yeah. But raw milk is still okay, right?
But give it time. Raw milk, yeah. Man. Do not
drink raw milk.
Gosh, have you ever tasted that?
Reason number 37.
Steve, if you took raw milk and you just boiled it on your stovetop, would that do it?
No, I don't think boiling is enough.
Maybe for some things, but also, like, wouldn't it weird your milk?
Yeah, you gotta. Yeah, why DIY that? You know, just let people who know what they're doing do it correctly. You know, like if they got it down to it, literally down to a science. Just let them do it.
You don't have to get angry with us. I'm just asking a question here.
Bad advice, Jay.
Yes, Steve, what have you been smoking?
Jesus Christ.
This means that a new study finds that introns, non-coding segments of genes, can affect protein folding independent of their effects on splicing is the fiction. I just wanted to talk about this news item because it's cool. It has nothing to do with protein folding.
You used us.
You just wanted to say intron over and over.
Yeah.
No, this is actually Google pretty. Blitz. What they were looking for, it's a little subtle, and I couldn't. The thing they were actually looking at was too subtle to make into a science fiction, so I just made something else up and made that the fiction. But here's the question. So again, I gave you the backstory about what introns and exons are. So, like, the whole gene is comprised of coding and non-coding segments. The entire gene gets transcribed, right? It gets turned into messenger RNA, a pre-messenger RNA. And then the messenger RNA gets chopped up to remove the intron segments to create the final mRNA, which then makes the protein only from the exons, right? So only from the coding, by definition, regions. Right? So by definition, the introns are the non-coding regions of the genes themselves. Now, they have been found to influence things like gene expression, right? How much of the protein are you going to make? The introns may influence that. They also are involved in regulating alternative splicing. So you could actually make multiple different proteins from the same gene by which of the exons you splice together, right? But here's the question. This is a very interesting question. Are they randomly placed in the gene? Or are the exons functional units?
And the introns are sort of like the scissors in CRISPR.
Are the exons these modules, a part of the protein? And so
they're bookended.
So one of the things that might practically what that might mean is that different amino acids and different sequences of amino acids have different effects on protein folding. Some segments of the protein fold and some don't, right? And some they fold in different ways. So is an exon coding for a part of the protein, the final protein, that has a specific folding functional unit that therefore evolutionarily functions as like this module that can be exchanged or moved around or whatever, right? So that's the question. So to address that question, they looked evolutionarily at different species, et cetera. They wanted to say, do exons, are they, if you look at the foldability of exons, is it varying randomly or is it varying not randomly? And what they found was that the answer was basically yes or no. But depending on this.
Depends.
Depending on whatever, the gene and the species or whatnot, but that definitely for some exons, there is a non-random distribution of the foldability, then to the point where they're calling some exons, I think, are foldons, as they use that term.
Oh my God.
It's a foldable unit of the protein. And so evolution is basically like, all right, I'll take one of these and two of those and we'll put them together. You know what I mean? It's like, we'll just take these exons and we'll switch them around. And that does happen. Like, exons do themselves get sort of swapped evolutionarily to different proteins and whatnot. And so here's the thing. Not all exons are conserved evolutionarily, but some exons that have a specific folding anatomy, right? Folding structure do get conserved more than you would predict at random. That's what they found. So for some exons, they basically evolved into this foldable module that then gets preserved as its own little subsection of a protein. Does that make sense? It's pretty cool. So it kind of supports that there, not all exons are foldons, but some are, from an evolutionary perspective. I thought that's the whole idea I find very neat. Mm-hmm. But it was hard to get a science or fiction out of that. So I just,
made it
to fiction and made it something else. But yeah, and I looked, I said, do introns affect folding? And it's always hard to prove a negative. As far as I could tell, with the time I had to search, I did multiple, you know, queries. I couldn't find anything, but it might just be because the way I was searching was just getting diverted to other questions. You know what I mean? Sometimes Google just makes certain matches and doesn't get to the money that I'm trying to get to. And I did, you know, whatever. So if somebody out there knows of a study which says that some intron affects the way proteins are being folded, let me know. I could not find that anywhere. And it makes sense that it wouldn't, because it really is just the sequence of the amino acids that's really affecting the folding. And I know that proteins could be folded in different ways, but I don't think it's the introns that does it, that controls the protein folding. Anyway, good job, guys. That was kind of a technical, tricky one, but yeah.
Well, yes, I didn't do a good job.
No, not you, Jay. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Rarely do the advocates of cleanses explain what is meant by toxins. It is one of those nebulous pseudoscientific terms rolled out by people deliberately avoiding the specificity required for a science-based analysis. It's the modern-day equivalent of evil spirits, vague enough to mean just about anything while retaining the ring of scientific legitimacy. Timothy Caulfield, from his book, Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? The famous elixirs of health, beauty, and happiness. And yeah, you're right, Jay. The answer is no. I mean, yes. Yes. Yes, she is wrong.
No, she is wrong.
No, yes, right. Yes, she is right. No.
Yeah, no, I love, it's a very good quote. Very pithy way of saying that. Yeah, we talk about that a lot on science-based medicine, the toxin gambit, as we call it. He's exactly right. And I love the analogy to evil spirits.
Yeah, it's like miasma.
Yeah, it's miasma. I love that word, miasma. It's so quaint. Love it.
Yeah. And Timothy Caulfield will be, as will we, at SciCon 2024, this coming October, out in Las Vegas. Join him. Join us. Come on out.
Join us, Bob.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you for joining me this week.
All right. See you next week.
Sure, man.
Bob, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Bob.
Thank you, peoples.
And see until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.